Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The name in the news today is that of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, alleged mastermind of Al-Qaeda, perhaps one of the key architects of the September 11th bombing, snatched from his bed in Rawalpindi, Pakistan on the weekend. He's now being held at an undisclosed location by U.S. interrogators. But this morning I have another name for you, Abdullah Al-Muhajir. He's better known by his other name, Jose Padilla. 331 days ago, he was whisked away from Chicago's O'Hare Airport. Currently held in a Navy brig in Charleston, South Carolina, he has not been charged with any crime. However, despite his American passport, Padilla has been branded an enemy combatant. President Bush called him a bad guy, a would-be killer. Attorney General John Ashcroft says Padilla trained in explosives in Afghanistan. Defense Secretary Rumsfeld has said Padilla may never face trial. So far, U.S. courts have refused to challenge the administration. Connection listeners, this hour look at the role of the courts in a time of crisis. How aggressive should the judiciary be in protecting the rights of a suspected terrorist like Jose Padilla? He is, after all, a U.S. citizen. And in a larger context, should the courts grant the executive branch more freedom when conducting a war, in this case their war on terrorism? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us on the program today, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his legal reporting, former New York Times columnist Tony Lewis. Welcome to the show. And joining us from New York, the University of Texas Law School, Professor Philip Bobbitt. He specializes in constitutional law and international security. Professor Bobbitt, welcome to you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'll start, Tony Lewis, with you because this case of Jose Padilla is one that seems a little stuck on your radar, and I want you to explain to me why.
Well, in a nutshell, here's an American citizen picked up at an American location, O'Hare Airport, and in a Navy brig with no charges brought against him, not allowed to see a lawyer, any lawyer, not allowed to see any member of his family or indeed anyone except his captors and his interrogators in that brig. And he may be there the rest of his life with no, not only due process, no process at all. And to me, it's astounding that an American citizen can just be swept up off the street and detained with no chance, really, to challenge the basis of the detention.
And the fact that we are now, however many months into this president's war on terror, that doesn't provide an adequate explanation for you to that?
No, because I think it is, you know, let's take it at its simplest. Governments make mistakes. They make mistakes all the time, and they say X is guilty of something, and then it turns out, well, we know that from the capital punishment cases. Series of people in Illinois who turned out were innocent once they got DNA tests, although successive prosecutors had sworn they were guilty and described them in the most, grim terms. Governments make mistakes, and that's why we have a judicial system. That's why we have due process. That's why we have cross-examination and a requirement of the government to produce evidence and subject to a hearing. None of those things happen in this case. And Mr. Padilla may be, as the president said, a bad guy, but he may not be. I mean, we don't know.
And there is the Fifth and there is the Sixth Amendment. Philip Bobbitt, you're a constitutional scholar. Do you have the same discomfort over this case as Tony Lewis?
Well, of course I do. It seems to me that we have a novel problem here, and it's one we have not hitherto really had to address. You have a war, but you have no battlefield front. You have no national state enemy. You have a sort of a virtual state or a terrorist network, Al-Qaeda. Now, suppose you capture someone in a war of this kind. What is he? If he's out of uniform, typically under traditional rules, then he's a spy, and he's an unlawful combatant. But if he's a terrorist and no one wears uniforms, does that make him a POW? I completely agree that we have to find a way to give all persons, not just American citizens. I'm not sure the citizen-alien distinction is really the important one here. We have to find a way to give them the proper process, the process that's due. Now, does that mean a judicial inquiry should be engaged? Yes, I think it does. Does that mean that the judiciary is the most appropriate entity, ultimately, to resolve how long this person can be detained? I would say it is one among several. But right now, we just don't have experience or rules with this novel kind of problem, and we need to develop those.
Are you saying we need new laws, new designations? Is it that novel a circumstance? As Tony points out, the man is a U.S. citizen.
Yes, he is a U.S. citizen. But suppose Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had had an American mother. Suppose he had a U.S. passport.
The fellow who was picked up on the weekend. Yeah,
that's right. I don't think that's either quite the right way to assess the problem of the enemy combatant out of uniform in a terrorist war, nor do I think it's entirely fair to aliens. I just don't think the citizen part is really the salient issue. The government has to obey rules.
I agree that
that's true whether with the citizens or aliens. Sorry.
I'm sorry, Professor Byman.
Not a bit.
I agree that the citizenship should not be the defining difference. It's only that I think to most of us the notion that an American can be picked up on the street in this country or at an airport and just taken away with no chance to talk to anyone and put away in a brig, essentially a military prison, for the rest of his life, is something rather troubling about that. Maybe it just seems to bother us more because it is an American inside our country. But, you know, your point is correct. We have a new problem here. And we have to find some way, at least to put it at its minimum, for people to claim that it's a case of mistaken identity. You've captured me, but I really was just standing there when something happened. It had nothing to do
with
me.
I think that's absolutely right.
Now, in December, a New York court did rule that Jose Padilla should be allowed to see a lawyer. The Justice Department, if I have my facts right, has said it will and is appealing that, so he has yet to see a lawyer. Is that, Tony, the way you understand it?
It's not quite right because the government did not go through the usual method of appeal to a higher court. It went back before the judge, who's called Judge Mukasey, a federal district judge in New York, and said, please change your mind. And they produced what bothered them, and to me the key thing is
them being the Justice Department or the court?
The Justice Department. What bothered the government lawyers was that the judge had ordered that Padilla be allowed to speak to a lawyer. It happened that a lawyer had been appointed on his behalf but could not speak to him. And the government came in and said, that would be terrible. That would threaten the national security. You can't let him speak to a lawyer. Please change your mind. And it produced an affidavit from the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, Vice Admiral Lowell Jacoby. It was really an extraordinary affidavit because it said that interrogation, not just of terrorists, of anybody, requires developing a relationship between the interrogators and the person being interrogated, which may take, I quote, months or even years to develop. Well, if you look past the rather polite language, what that means is if we can keep him alone in solitary confinement for months or even years, we can break his will. I mean, that's just the process, whether it takes place in a totalitarian society or in an American prison. And that's the sort of thing that's a reason for having a lawyer. Usually, in Miranda or other cases, we want to have lawyers so people's will not be broken. Well, we can ask ourselves, do we want to open the way to this kind of will-breaking technique because terrorism is so serious? That's the issue.
That is the issue. But I don't know that the exclusive way to characterize this is the criminal model or the criminal model of prosecution, Miranda rights, and a lawyer. Now, I certainly agree with the Southern District that he ought to be allowed to see counsel. But the general characterization of the alternatives as either lawless or a criminal prosecution probably shouldn't exhaust all of our possibilities. We need something more creative than simply a charge, a prosecution, and trial, because some of these figures may be persons against whom we cannot get convictions because the information is hearsay, although quite credible, because we may not want to disclose the information we have, because we feel, as perhaps is the case with Padilla, that he has more information, and we're more interested in preventing future crimes than we are in prosecuting past ones or attempts. These are new problems for this society.
But the last thing you mentioned, Professor, carries with it a certain amount of trust. Trust that the citizens have to give to the Attorney General, to the Justice Department, and ultimately to the President to make those decisions in a situation where there isn't that sort of judicial review. Am I right about that?
Well, there is judicial review. If by that you mean a habeas corpus petition, that's why the Southern District heard this case in the first place.
But it's a very limited kind of review because Judge Mukasey and in the other case, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, the Hamdi case, which perhaps we'll mention, said that the president has the right to detain somebody in this way indefinitely without a lawyer if he or his agent, the attorney general, the prosecutor, produces some evidence. Now, that really means any evidence, not subject to cross-examination, not subject to any kind of hearing. Now, that's a very minimal kind of habeas corpus proceeding.
Yes, but I suppose if you have someone captured on a battlefield in Afghanistan...
This is Yasser Hamdi, the man we're talking about.
That's the other man, yes.
If someone captured on a battlefield, that seems a little closer to the POW or perhaps the unlawful combatant model, with which we are really quite familiar and which I doubt courts in the past would have wanted to subject to cross-examination and hearing and so forth.
That's true.
A hearing beyond the habeas hearing.
Yes, that's the distinction in the cases. What makes Padilla different is that, you know, he wasn't captured on the battlefield.
That's right.
He was captured at O'Hare Airport.
And that's the problem. You have no particular battle line. You don't have a leading edge of the battlefield. You don't have someone in uniform advancing across the front.
Are we then, Tony, in new and unfamiliar territory, as the professor's saying?
Yes, we are. I agree. I'll just add one footnote. Even if someone is captured on the battlefield, there may be factual issues. All kinds of people are found on battlefields, especially a confused, chaotic one, as in Afghanistan. Members of the press, for example. Now, I'm not saying Mr. Hamdi was a member of the press, but different people are found on battlefields, not just fighters. And it's not clear who captured Hamdi. He may have been captured by the Northern Alliance, the Afghans, rather than American troops. And there's a lot of slippage there as to, you know, what the facts were. So even in that case, there is some reason for disquiet about the lack of any factual process.
Well, I think there ought to be fact-finding, but and we have methods of fact-finding in warfare to address the very problems that you just raised, that is, noncombatants who are swept up in the aftermath of war and battle. Usually those are military hearings. They are very different from criminal hearings because their purpose, their context is so different. But it's not as though the government has any interest in just sweeping up people and feeding them and herding them into pens. The government also wants some effective process.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, the so-called war on terror has changed the judicial process in the United States. How much has it changed? And are you comfortable with the differences and the distinctions that we're talking about? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour, conversation about the courts in times of national crisis. With me in the studio, Tony Lewis, former New York Times columnist covering the U.S. Supreme Court, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner for his reporting, author of a number of books, including Gideon's Trumpet, about the landmark right to counsel decision by the Supreme Court. And joining us from New York, the professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas, Philip Bobbitt. He was associate counsel to President Carter, working in areas of intelligence and international security. He's the author most recently of a book called The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of history. So, Professor, let's talk about a little history here, because whenever this comes up, whenever we talk about, you know, how well the executive branch does in looking out for the people at a given time, everybody talks about the Sedition Acts of 1798 and the Palmer Raids of 1919, 2 years after the Bolshevik Revolution, when 5,000 people were picked up after a series of mail bombs. We talk about the internment of Japanese Americans at the time of the Second World War. And they're all used as examples that the executive can screw up.
Yeah, well, having served a number of executive roles, I can certainly say that's exactly right. The executive can make all sorts of mistakes. However, think about that progress. Think about the very cases you cited, the early Sedition Acts, which seem so shocking to us now, then Korematsu and the internment of Japanese Americans, which we find so distasteful, the Palmer Raids, and then contrast that with, for example, the Youngstown case. Now, that occurred at the height of the Korean War.
The Youngstown case.
President Truman, in the midst of a steel strike and worrying that we would not have sufficient ammunition and steel for weapons in the Korean theater, was forced, he felt, to take over the steel mills for a period without statutory authorization by Congress to keep them running. The case went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court denied him that authority, even though they were quite in sympathy with his general program, and they were loath to interfere with war production.
So you're saying that each one of these cases that I cited, there is a learning process here.
I am. In fact, that's a nice way of putting it. So much of our history, often history we regret, is really quite beneficial to us because it shows us how to navigate when we are in uncertain waters. And some of the things that we wish we'd done otherwise help us to respond more firmly with present challenges.
The only thing I'd say about that, Professor Bobbitt, is that, yes, alas, from my point of view, alas, Youngstown, the Supreme Court decision in the Truman Steel case, was rather an isolated one. We haven't had another decision since then in which the court has been willing to really look at and judge a presidential action described as necessary to fight a war. It's, on the whole, been very, the court has been very submissive, very deferential to presidential claims, and Youngstown really stands alone, in my judgment.
I'm glad you raised that point, because it comes out of a very powerful piece that you wrote just the other day that I was sent to the New York Times. Sometimes we think of the judiciary as the only constitutional decider or as an exclusive constitutional decider. And if there are not Supreme Court cases, we assume that the executive is acting lawlessly. But, of course, that's not so. More constitutional law is probably made and decided by Congress and the executive than by all the courts in America combined. And I think we sometimes mistake that fact. The real test of whether or not we have learned these lessons is not how many Supreme Court pages are devoted to them. It's how they have made their way into the consciousness and the practices of the executive and of the Congress. And there I think we make a mistake to neglect that side. Perhaps it's the issue of trust you mentioned earlier. I don't think that the people in the Army who are holding these hearings, the people in the Justice Department who are professionals and who are not partisans, I don't think they're people from whom we should withdraw trust because they're not judges.
I'd agree with that, but are you confident that the present directors of the Justice Department, to take up your last point, are as nonpartisan as you say? Do you have a confidence in them, in their judgment, confidence that they are taking into account history and the needs of the Constitution?
I have enormous confidence in the professionals at the Justice Department who are not political appointments. They go on from decade to decade. Yes, I think those are very sensitive persons. In fact, as we saw in the aftermath of 9/11, with respect to the FBI and information sharing, sometimes they actually bend over too far, I think, and they have instituted rules about sharing prosecutorial information that we rather regret now.
But my question was deliberately not about the professionals, but about those in charge.
Yes, I know it was. But I,
Go ahead, Professor.
Well,
I mean, it's a difficult one, because if you take a look at the way that these issues have been reported over the past 18 months, you know, we could go on at some considerable length just making a list of what's changed under the USA Patriot Act, list of what's changed at the INS and the registration of foreign students and the way that aliens, illegal and otherwise, are treated in the country. We drop Guantanamo Bay into the soup and go on and on about the way that various freedoms taken for granted for some considerable period of time have been altered.
Well, you know, that's another point I'm glad you raised, because I may be somewhat out of sympathy with the way this is usually portrayed.
Right.
I think government is there to protect our rights. That is its main purpose. But the main protector of our rights is not the Supreme Court, or not courts for that matter. And our main rights are not the rights we look to when in a criminal case. The main protector of our rights is the 101st Airborne. It's not a district judge. And what has changed is that we now find ourselves faced with serious threats to our lives, to our liberties, to the way we ordinarily go about our business. That's what's changed. And in the aftermath, rules that we set up really in the mid-70s as a reaction to Watergate, when again trust was quite rightly withdrawn, it's those rules that are changing, not sort of a force of themselves, but because the world in which they've operated has changed.
I agree with your premise, Professor Bobbitt. I think we all have felt since 9/11 a different sense of vulnerability in this country, which has profound psychological effects on not just Justice Department lawyers and attorneys general, but citizens. That's true. On the other hand, I think some things have changed in a way that have not reflected the kind of consideration for ordinary understandings of human rights, or decencies, if you'd say that, that are not justified by the fear. I'll give you an example, more or less at random. A distinguished Pakistani newspaper editor was invited to the United States by the State Department. He came, was stationed at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and Pakistan is on a list of 25 countries, all but one of them population Muslim, overwhelming Muslim, from which visitors have to register before 40 days are up after they arrive in the United States. He was told he did not have to do that because he was a guest of the country. On the 40th day, he was going into the Brookings Institution when two men in civilian clothes showed guns and grabbed him as he was going in, and said he had failed to register and they were taking him to a prison. This is right on the street. And he said, well, could I go and get my notes? And they said, yes, we'd like to see the notes. Fortunately, as he was taken in, the director of the program to which he was attached saw what was happening, called up somebody in the State Department. It happened that the foreign minister of Pakistan was in Washington that day, and he was a friend of this editor. And he took it up with Attorney General Ashcroft and Secretary of State Powell. You can't get higher level intervention than that. And he was released at the end of the day. Anybody else would have gone to that prison in Virginia and been deported without any chance whatever to call an aide, a lawyer, a friend, nothing. And I think that's a wrong system.
All right. We'll talk a little bit further about that, but we have a number of people who want to join us on the telephone. So if I can go first to Wilmington, Massachusetts, and Quincy's on the line. Hi, Quincy.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
My comment has to do with, or my question has to do with the fact that we seem to be operating in the shadow of, I think, a process which is sanctioned. The Constitution provides the executive with the power to suspend habeas corpus during wartime, a situation which I believe has occurred once before. I think Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus during the Civil War. But there seems to be a real reluctance to engage in the debate and the necessary steps to invoke that power now, and I'm kind of wondering why, and doesn't that perhaps illuminate some way out of this system where we're sort of trapped in between an official process, which may have to do with criminals or wartime process with military tribunals, and something else where it can be officially constitutionally sanctioned? Thank you.
All right, thanks for your question. Professor, do you want to start there?
Sure. The Constitution does provide Congress with the power to suspend habeas corpus. I don't know that that's really where we ought to be, I don't think that would be supported in Congress, and I think probably properly so. However, your caller does raise an excellent point, and that is the necessity to engage other branches of government than the executive, and not just the judiciary. I heard an interesting proposal that runs something like this. Where there's no conventional battle line and where a nation state's armies are not in the field, as in the conventional wars, that we should have a declaration of war that had to be renewed every 2 years. Because there is a concern that what ought to be a war on terrorists or on Al-Qaeda will become a war on terrorism. And someone might really be detained or held in a brig for some indefinite period. Something like a declaration of war, and I don't simply mean the usual resolutions or statutes, which might serve in a conventional context, but something like a declaration of war with a time limit that had to be renewed might bring the body of Congress and its oversight into some of these matters.
I think Professor Barbett is more optimistic about the United States Congress than I am. I haven't seen any sign of its sensitivity to issues like this. The call of patriotism covers a lot of things, and during a war, especially when the public feels so vulnerable after 9/11, members of Congress are going to be very reluctant and have been very reluctant to do anything that could look like a challenge to the executive that is prosecuting the war. That's why we rely on courts, and, you know, I might agree with Professor Bobbitt that we rely too much, but judges are insulated from direct pressures of patriotism, so-called, or real patriotism. They're there to make detached judgments, and I think in this kind of situation, they're better able to do it. I'll stop there.
Well, I think to the connection.
Respond to this, and I think that's why we don't want to suspend habeas corpus. We do want a role for judges. Whether it should be the same role as in crime, I think here we may differ.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Hillsborough now, North Carolina, and Andy's joining us. Hi, Andy.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Hi, I'm just have to be in agreement with Mr. Lewis and aghast at what Mr. Bobbitt has said.
Be specific, Andy. There's a lot on the table here.
Okay.
There's a lot to be aghast about.
Specifically about trusting an administration to basically decide when we are at war and how long a war could go on, and that we can suspend the rights of American citizens. Padilla hasn't been convicted of a crime. He hasn't even, as far as I know, been charged. He's been put in jail without access to lawyers. You look at, was it John Walker? He had access to lawyers.
Andy, can I give you a hypothetical question? What if it turned out that Jose Padilla had been the one who had pinpointed the location of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, this so-called, Al-Qaeda mastermind? Would you feel any different, any more willing to
I don't think so. I think, you know, it would be great that he pinpointed him, but no, I wouldn't, because that doesn't necessarily mean it would have prevented anything. This seems to be a witch hunt all over the country, using the Immigration Service to persecute Arabs, holding people in detention camps in Guantanamo without access to lawyers. When you look at it, 3,000 people were killed, and that was awful. It was a horrible act. But we've killed many more people than that in Afghanistan. McVeigh bombed the building in Kansas. We didn't go on a witch hunt after that.
Okay, let's try and stick to the Padilla case here.
Right. We're a scared nation, and we're suddenly willing to throw the rights that our forefathers fought for and thought were one of the most important and sacred things out the window because a group of fanatics flew planes into buildings. And that's what really bothers me. What I see happening in the future is we're going to have demonstrations about the war in Iraq, and they're going to use aspects of that law to round up people to prevent them from demonstrating.
Okay, let me, if I can, just stick to the Padilla and turn to the professor. What really could be, would be, might be lost by giving Padilla the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state? We sort of end up there in any time we talk about it.
Well, I I think your caller raises an excellent counterexample to his own point. In the case of John Walker Lynn, who was captured on the battlefield, we decided that a criminal prosecution was appropriate. In his case, they must have felt that nothing would be lost. Of all the thousands of people rounded up, you're talking about, I believe, two persons. Two persons, Yamsar Hamdi and Jose Padilla.
Now, two that we know about. Is that being
I wasn't aware there was
paranoid?
Any.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes, I don't. It strikes me as excessively paranoid, but perhaps I'm inured to this, as your caller suggests. I don't see a great witch hunt going on, and I don't think this is just a sort of a psychological phenomenon. I think we are in a war. I don't think the administration should, as your caller suggests, be the sole department to define this, to say how long it can go on, to say what its parameters should be. I think that has to be done with the Congress. But I do not think that it is wise or appropriate or even reasonable to say that we are on the verge of rounding up demonstrators because we have one person who was intercepted on the way, we are told, to assembling and using a radiological bomb. I just don't see that.
Tony Lewis.
It's true that there are only two people thus being held without counsel and without trial and without charge. But it's the principle that's dangerous. If the government prevails in its assertion that on its own motion and on its own evidence with no cross-examination, no lawyer, no way to challenge it effectively, they can take anybody and hold that person indefinitely, I think that's a very dangerous principle for everybody, not just for those two. And secondly, Professor Bobbitt, you've quite accurately stated that, you know, this is not an army. They don't wear uniforms. It's all very vague. But that gives very great discretion, rather chilling discretion in my view, to the president. Because this is not a war that's going to end in some defined way with, the enemy trooping on board the United States, whatever it was, Missouri.
I'm going to stop you there, and we'll give Professor Bobbitt a chance to respond when we come back after the break. Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. With me on the program today, Philip Bobbitt, professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas School of Law, the A.W. Walker Centennial Chair in that department, former counselor on international law at the Department of State, also worked with President Carter and the Senate Select Committee. And with me in the studio, Tony Lewis, former New York Times columnist covering the U.S. Supreme Court, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on judicial matters, and author of a number of books, including Gideon's Trumpet, about the landmark right to counsel decision by the Supreme Court. And we were talking about the principle here of the men being held rather than the number. And, Tony, you just wanted to finish your point before we pass it over to the professor. This was on the notion that it's not an army in uniform that war on terror faces.
And it's not going to end in the way that wars end, usually. When we fought the Germans and the Japanese, that war came to an end. It was long, but it came to a defined end, and the Japanese came on board the U.S. Missouri and gave up. That's not going to happen here, and it's going to be in the discretion of this or some other president to say, well, the war on terrorism or terrorists is over. We don't know when that's going to be. It could go on, really, for the rest of my life, at least. And that's a very worrying thing and a reason, I think, for the courts to be more stalwart than they usually are in examining the premises of executive power in wartime.
Professor Bobbitt.
Yes, I've been thinking about the phrase, the principle of the thing. And I think there is a principle here. I'm not sure it's the same principle that we would apply in criminal cases. In criminal cases, we have a cliché. We say it's better that 100 guilty men go free and that one innocent man be imprisoned. And I think that characterizes and should characterize our attitude towards that principle. But turn it around. Isn't it better to detain one person than to jeopardize the lives of hundreds, perhaps thousands, of innocent persons? Because That's the equation in terrorism. And it is not simply a criminal model. Now, do I think we should have habeas corpus? Of course I do. Should there be cross-examination? Cross-examination, for example, if not by counsel, by the judge? Of course I do. Do I think that judges will play an important role in this, the judges that Mr. Lewis wants to insert in the process? Yes, I do. One important role will be to build the trust and independent examination that he wants. But is the criminal model the only model? Aren't we wasting a lot of our energy simply focusing on that model rather than trying to develop new models that are sensitive to this new phenomenon?
Like that deal with issues of national security, that deal with issues of homeland security? Is that what you're talking about?
That deal with wars that, for example, don't have a grand declaration and a peace treaty. That's another reason why I'm intrigued by the suggestion that the Congress should have to pass some kind of joint resolution that expires after every 2 years, that grants authority only for a certain period. That was the original purpose of the Declaration of War Clause, and I think it could play a very creative role in the 21st century. It just isn't enough to say, this is all a psychological phenomenon, people are terrified, they're reacting irrationally, the courts are supine. That seems insufficient to me.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. To Melrose, Massachusetts now. John's joining us. Hello, John.
Hi, this is just a great show. I don't remember the names. I don't need to know them. But the professor who was just speaking,
yes,
where he just went, I think, is a tremendously important point, and that is that we almost need new institutions. The problem is I think both professors have something extremely valuable to contribute here. What I think the greatest danger is that the two views, the one that's solely concerned with civil rights and the other view that's solely concerned with getting all the terrorists and locking them up without trial, the polarization is the most dangerous thing for us. Because if there's polarization, it'll never get resolved, and the current situation will continue. What's really needed is probably special courts, special judges, and a compromise where certain kinds of evidence.
Let me just stop you for a minute, John. Are you talking about special courts that would adjudicate on the issues here, or special courts that would deal with each individual who was charged or who was picked up?
Wow, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer. My gut. I'll just give you my gut, and maybe get off. But special court that could give someone a trial, like Padilla. Padilla could get his trial, but there would be certain restrictions on evidence that don't get to the public. So the public doesn't get to hear, the press doesn't get all the evidence, but the press gets some of the fundamental evidence.
Sort of like a military tribunal.
Yes, but I wouldn't leave it to the military. That makes me a little nervous. I would put it in the civilian realm, but in like a special terrorism court. And I think there needs to be a national discussion about how does this court work so that enough is revealed so that we know civil rights are not being destroyed. But at the same time, if Padilla, like you said before, knew where this number three al-Qaeda guy was, that wouldn't be sent to the press during the court proceedings.
Okay, John, let me hear from Tony Lewis here.
Thank you.
I'm in general skeptical of the idea of special courts. We've usually rejected that in this country, not always, but usually because we rely on the breadth and of experience and humanity of judges of general jurisdiction. But I think there is something to the point. I will say to the caller that we already have a statute which allows the government in prosecutions where national security issues are at stake to withhold certain kinds of evidence. And the judge may be able to see it and others not. And I would think, following up your suggestion, I think that's a possibility. I don't know that I disagree with Professor Bobbitt about not following too far the criminal justice model. But he has already accepted what I regard as the essentials, and I think it was crucially important that he said what he did. There has to be a place for testing the government's evidence, whether by the judge. There has to be some process that will test the truth because, I simply will tell you from experience, the government very often says the national security will be destroyed if it doesn't have its way. And it's often wrong. It said that in the Pentagon Papers case, which was, frankly, a joke. It said that in the Japanese relocation case, Korematsu. It was essential to the national security that all those Japanese Americans be removed from the West Coast. That was a false statement based on false evidence, some of it knowingly false. So I'm just not as trustful about government statements.
Professor, do you think that the judicial tools are in the box, the courts of appeal, the Supreme Court? I mean, we are fairly early on in this process, and some lower courts have already started to get engaged with the issues that we're discussing.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do think the judicial tools are in the box, although I'm intrigued by the caller's suggestion that perhaps we might have something to supplement them. And I also take the caller's point, which I think is an awfully important one, that perhaps the worst outcome of this debate could be an increasing polarization. If we find in this country that some substantial number of our people really don't trust judges, they don't trust the judiciary, they don't trust the Department of Justice, they don't trust the Congress, and they certainly don't trust the Army or the executive, then I think we will find that it is impossible even to make progress in this war. And the more we try to end it, the more we will tear ourselves apart. The fundamental issue your caller raises, and one I gather Mr. Lewis has also been addressing, is trust.
But help me, if you can, with the difference between this fundamental polarization and the fundamental power of debate that goes on in the country, where you have intelligent, passionate people saying, get that guy before a court, and other people saying, no, and here are the reasons why not. I mean, you don't want to choke that off.
No, you certainly don't. But I think that I think responsible people always should say, you know, hang on now. This is not a witch hunt. We are not gunning down demonstrators. You know, put this in perspective. These are career civil servants who are acting. They are not maddened by an upcoming election. I may have a different temperament than Mr. Lewis, where our institutions are concerned. Maybe we've had different roles, but I do think that the essential nature of the question will revolve around what institutions will ultimately lead our people to have faith in the course that's prosecuted in their name.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Tony.
Like Professor Barbett, I'm a great believer in institutions, and especially in the Justice Department, which I covered for 7 years, and I entirely agree with him that the professionals in that department are first class and deserve our trust. But, you know, there are different attorneys general at different times, and let me just say this, and I don't mean to be ad hominem here, it's just something that I've experienced. If Edward Levy were the Attorney General today, I'd have a lot more trust. I'll just say a word about who he is, because we forget in this country we have short historical memories. Edward Levy was the Attorney General appointed by President Ford. He was president of the University of Chicago and a distinguished lawyer, rather conservative in temperament, but solidly in favor of the Constitution, enforcing the Constitution, and very concerned about those issues. And, you know, I think that is part of preventing this clash that the caller and Professor Bobbitt want to prevent, and of course I agree. You have to have that degree of trust, and that degree of trust has to be earned, and I don't think it's been earned as yet in this administration.
I'm thinking of the example that you raised earlier in the program, though, of the Pentagon Papers, because the Attorney General who argued that that was a matter of national security at the time was William Rehnquist, was he not?
No. No. Rehnquist was an assistant attorney general.
Oh, okay.
The attorney general was John Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
I will point out, again, not ad hominem, but it is a fact that he went to prison later in connection with Watergate.
So
I didn't have a lot of confidence in him, let's put it that way.
You're bringing together that which already exists, and that is politics. And,
yes, it's
and,
there.
Yeah, exactly. And Professor Bobbitt, I mean, yes. if we're not talking about the professional integrity of the lawyers at the Justice Department, because I don't think anybody on the program is calling their integrity into question. But yes. Once you get into politics, then you create that, or you're back into that, you know, who trusts who question, aren't you?
Well, and not just career prosecutors and civil servants, but also military personnel. There is an assumption many of my students make that everyone in the military is a sort of robot, that they will obey unlawful orders, that they will do cruel and stupid things because some political figure at some lofty level tells them to do that. And this is simply untrue.
Let me just say that I agree completely. It is simply untrue. I have quite a high degree of confidence in the American military. I wanted to make one other slightly different point. We've been talking about how do you deal with the new phenomenon of virulent terrorism. Well, there's one country that's been dealing with it for, you know, a very long time, 45 years. That's Israel. And the Supreme Court of Israel has gradually, not always consistently, but gradually developed the position that you have to stick to your legal guns. You can't copy the terrorists in abandoning law. You must stick to your guns. And they've handed down some very important decisions, for example, outlawing the use of torture, even when it is alleged that the person being tortured may have important information that you can get only by torture. I think that's a lesson that we might well keep in mind.
You actually quote Aaron Barak, president of the Israeli Supreme Court, in a recent piece in which he says the real test of independence and impartiality comes in situations of war and terrorism. Professor, do we have something to learn from Israel here?
No, I don't know enough about the Israeli experience to really say, but I will say that we have something to learn from so many societies on this because we just haven't had to face it before. And Israel has been on the front line. They have an experience that we can profit from. They're a very very sophisticated society about law. I suspect my hope is that we can adapt these institutions of our own, perhaps on the Israeli basis, perhaps through creating new methods. Just as Tony Lewis suggests, that is, always keeping in mind our fundamental purposes, never shirking from our duty because of the political conflict, but being sensitive to the facts that are changing before our eyes.
And we are well served by those of you who teach the law and those of you who write about it in places that we all get to read about it. So, Tony Lewis, thanks so much for coming in. Tony Lewis is a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, former New York Times columnist. And Philip Bobbitt, thanks for your time.
Thanks so much.
Professor Bobbitt is at the University of Texas Law School. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. Coming up next in the second hour of The Connection with Dick Gordon, all about the Dante Club, with the author...